From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 150,000 American soldiers will fight and sleep and patrol tonight in Iraq. Many more are deployed in Afghanistan and around the world. But few among them are the children of those who lead the country, who control its resources and institutions, who enjoy its greatest affluence. My guest tonight says that is wrong. This hour on Point, why America's educated elite do not serve, and an argument for why they should. We begin tonight with the latest on the Pentagon's recruitment problems. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Army heads today delayed a decision until 2006 about whether to permanently expand the Army. But the Army Reserve, Army National Guard, and most recently the Marines are already having trouble meeting their recruitment goals. In January, the Marines missed their monthly recruitment target for the first time in almost a decade. Mark Mazzetti is defense reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him about the U.S. military's recruiting challenge.
The Army and the Marine Corps, as you know, are facing significant commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what we're seeing is that since 9/11, the Army specifically is having trouble hitting its recruitment and retention numbers. The Marine Corps, for the first time last month, missed a recruiting goal, and that's really the first time in a decade. We've started to see the problems in the Army earlier, and those problems are really surfacing most in the Reserve and National Guard.
I'm seeing the Guard meeting only 56% of its quota in January. That's a big shortfall.
It is, and so far for this fiscal year, they're at about 80%. And there's a few things going on. One is that I think people are more reluctant to join the National Guard because they're seeing this probably means a ticket to Iraq, whereas it used to just mean a week and a month. The other thing is that because members of the active duty Army are being kept in the Army longer, that's drying up the pool to go into the National Guard. Usually about 50% of people leaving active duty went into the National Guard. That's down now to about 35%. So the National Guard's pool of active duty recruits is shrinking as well.
How serious is the crunch that this is putting the U.S. military in?
The Army says that it's becoming increasingly a problem. They say, though, that they'll muddle through. The Guard and the Reserve will be able to provide troops to fill out units on the way to Iraq and Afghanistan. They're at a stretching point, but they're not at a crisis point. So they say that they can definitely get through this, but the next year, certainly, when we don't expect a significant drawdown in Iraq, is going to be very difficult.
As you say, they are maintaining their troop strength in no small part by extending the tours of duty of servicemen right now, the so-called stop-loss orders that are keeping people from getting out. How many thousands of U.S. military men and women would like to be getting out now but cannot?
It's over 10,000, and the numbers have been fluctuating over the past year. But in terms of the total number that have been stop-lost since 9/11, it's in the tens of thousands. Some of those have since been released and let out. And you saw this in December when Secretary Rumsfeld went to Kuwait and was asked some pretty pointed questions from reservists and guardsmen about stop loss and about equipment given to the National Guard. And that's just one piece of evidence of some tension out there.
Marines have traditionally not had much trouble recruiting, but Marines have suffered about a third of the deaths in Iraq. They've taken a big hit.
That's right. They do a tremendous recruiting effort. At the same time, the 1st Marine Division, which led the charge towards Baghdad along with the Army 3rd Infantry, they're back already just finishing up their second tour in Iraq. They were the first unit to return for a second tour, and it's more than likely they may see a third in the not-too-distant future. So again, when you're signing up for either the active duty service or the Guard or Reserve, right now it's looking like you're seeing multiple tours in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Air Force and Navy, on the other hand, have no problem hitting their goals. What's up with that?
Yeah, they actually have too many people. They are having no trouble and, in fact, are looking to reduce the total manpower in those two services. Largely what's happening is that both the Air Force and the Navy are what they call platform-specific services in that they've got ships and they've got planes, and they just need enough people to man those ships and planes, and they don't need extras. The Army and the Marines, on their hand, are manpower-driven. They need soldiers, they need Marines to fill out units to deploy to carry out these missions. So the Air Force and the Navy are looking at what their needs are, and because they also want more money to buy ships and planes, they're looking to reduce the manpower costs over the next few years.
But the Army's got problems. What kind of incentives is the Army and Reserves, what are they offering to get people in, to keep people in?
Right now, the Army National Guard is giving $15,000 for reenlistment bonuses. So if you're already in the National Guard, you get another $15,000 to re-up. And actually, the early indications are that that's working, that they're getting people to stay in the service because of this money. Now, there's nothing new. The bonuses are not new. But the Army National Guard specifically had to triple their retention bonuses because they really saw a tremendous problem in keeping the soldiers in the Guard.
If the U.S. military were asked to get into any other significant conflict at the moment, could it do it with its existing force, or would we be looking at something else, maybe the draft?
You'd be hard-pressed, I think, to find anyone in the Pentagon who would say we could carry out another large-scale engagement like what's going on in Iraq right now. The things that they need, what they call in Pentagon speak, low-density, high-demand units, the things that they're just not enough of, they're being used up in Iraq, and they could not be diverted to another conflict. I think the experience in Iraq, not the war itself, but the aftermath, the peacekeeping effort that's tied down so many troops in Iraq, has got a lot of people thinking twice about just what the capabilities are of the U.S. military to do other things.
But if it happened, a draft?
You don't hear anyone talking about a draft, at least publicly. Rumsfeld has said for over a year that this is a non-starter. It will not happen. There are some members of Congress who are talking about it, but at least the Pentagon is reading the American public's state of mind right now, and I don't think they think a draft is feasible.
Mark Mazzetti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark Mazzetti is defense reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. You may not be interested in war, said Leon Trotsky, but war is interested in you. Especially, says our guest tonight, if you are educated, affluent, and feeling exempt. For too long now, says Lieutenant General Josiah Bunting III, America's best and brightest, or at least its privileged, have been stepping away from military service. The consequences, he says, are bad, and many, including a situation where those who most benefit from a safe home front now look with condescension or incomprehension on soldiering themselves. You may or may not like the war in Iraq, but what does it mean when someone else, maybe some other class, is fighting it? Tonight on Point, debating a place in the U.S. Armed Forces for America's most privileged, most educated, maybe even for you. You can join the conversation. Are America's privileged ducking out of military service, depending on other Americans to keep the country safe? Do you remember a time when all Americans, even the elite, served in the armed forces? Is it reasonable to expect that they should now? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Lieutenant General Josiah Bunting III. As superintendent of the Virginia Military Institute, he opposed, then oversaw, the Supreme Court ordered integration of women into that formerly all-male academy. He served in Vietnam as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army and was awarded a Bronze Star. He's a former Rhodes Scholar. He's president of the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation in New York City. His essay in the winter issue of The American Scholar is Class Warfare. It is wrong that America's most privileged families have abandoned military service. General Bunting, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with me in the studio tonight, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you right here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
General Bunting, make your case. Why is it a problem that the best and brightest, or at least the most privileged, are not in the ranks?
Since about 1994, the country has paid great and respectful and affectionate attention to what we call the greatest generation, that generation that waded ashore at Normandy and fought in the South Pacific. These are people who are now in their late 70s and 80s. When you talk to these people about what they did in the war, they invariably, modestly turn away from talking about specifics of their own service. They say simply, I was in the service. The notion of military service as something that you give to the country of your birth, the country that sustains you, the country that provides opportunities, is a notion which I regret to say seems to be in tatters. In 1898, in 1918, in 1941, people rushed to the colors. And the people that rushed to the colors the fastest were people at Harvard and Stanford and Williams, places of academic and educational privilege. Those people now are the last people to consider joining up, with a few exceptions. And I think the country is the poorer for it, and I think those people, much later in life, when they're 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, will be the poorer for it also.
And why do you think it's happening? Is it because they're wimping out, or they don't agree with the foreign policy they see being exercised abroad?
I think it's a variety of things. I think more than anything else, it has to do with the unglamorous nature of military service as they perceive it. I think also that the last three wars that we have been involved in have been, for the most part, unpopular wars that have gone on without any sense of a palpable resolution. I think there's something else. I think there is a condescension, particularly among academic people, academic administrators and professors, towards military service, and I think some of them actively discourage it. I mentioned in the article the case, for example, of Pat Tillman, who was a professional football player.
Famously so.
He joined up and he served proudly and heroically in Afghanistan.
Died under friendly fire there. The nation was all attuned to that.
That's right. It's interesting to remember, by the same token, in World War II, 345 Major League Baseball players joined up and served. I'm not saying that the country's interest in those two wars is identical. But I am saying that when people who are given the most or who earn the most for themselves in a variety of professions don't consider military service part of their option, part of the things they ought to be doing, the country is very much the poorer for it.
Josiah Bunting, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Jack Beatty, I'm eager to hear what you have to say on this. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about privileged America. Ducking out of the military in time of war, would it change national policy? If the sons and daughters of the rich patrolled Fallujah, what happens to American ideals when the country's luckiest citizens don't fight its wars? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the most privileged Americans leaving national defense to other Americans, to somebody else. It's a complicated, charged issue. Lots of cross currents running through here. You can join the conversation tonight. Is there something wrong when a huge swath of upper income, upper educated America is essentially absent from America's defense? And what does it mean that the best and brightest, or at least the most privileged, served and died in two world wars and more, and now are no-shows in the U.S. military? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is Lieutenant General Josiah Bunting III. His essay in the winter issue of The American Scholar is Class Warfare. It is wrong that America's most privileged families have abandoned military service. Josiah Bunting, I wish you'd paint the picture, at least as you see it. Fill it in a little more here. What are you saying? Who was in the military then, and define what you mean by then, and who's not in it now that you're concerned about as a class?
Yeah. Well, the classic legacy of World War II, as we think of World War II in films and movies and pictures and politics, is the infantry squad. And the infantry squad is a miniature melting pot of America. It is represented geographically, ethnically, in almost every conceivable way. A group of young people come together, young men, usually under the watchful eye of an angry sergeant, and they soldier together for a year or so. Most of them survive, and they come out immensely the better for it as American citizens. They feel a frisson of Americanness for the rest of their lives, the way you and I felt, let's say, in the week after 9/11. Mm. That, on its face, is a very good thing, to have people from all walks of life thrown together in a common purpose. Incidentally, some of that common purpose is unpleasant. Some of it is dangerous. And I would go a step further and say this, that if in the fullness of time many of these people become government officials, elected officials, politicians, and so on, it's of inestimable benefit to them, to the people that they command, and the people in this country, that they themselves have some sense of what it is they are asking other people to do.
So there's the iconic platoon from World War II in Hollywood's view, and in fact, in many cases, you're saying. So now bring us up to date. Who's missing from that platoon today?
Well, we have an all-volunteer army, and we have had, Tom, since 1973. If you look at the casualty lists in the papers, look, for example, at those 31 Marines, the 30 Marines and the sailor who went down 3 weeks ago in the big Marine chopper.
Mm-hmm. The Sea Stallion.
Look at those kids, where they're from, what their ages are. Singularly underrepresented, missing, are the kids to whom our culture gives the most by way of opportunities, by way of education. I use the phrase in the article, a clerisy. That's an old-fashioned word that basically means the professional classes who benefit the most. Those kids are not going into the military. The ROTC units at many of the famous and most competitive colleges are very small, if they exist at all. I think the campuses tend to look down on military service. So I think that's one of the great losses to the country.
That they're just not there. You say it's a loss to the country. You suggest that it's also perhaps eventually, maybe even soon, a problem within the military. You put together a kind of marching jingle here in 2005 that might echo in 1895. You can imagine today's soldiers saying, we don't want to fight by jingo, but by jingo if we do, the smart and privileged people, they'd better join us too.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only can they bring skills and talents to the table, I mean, these are immensely well-educated, well-nourished, well-fed Americans, all of that kind of thing, but they can bring enormous skills to the table, particularly when they go in as younger officers. But almost invariably, those kids stay away from service. There was a well-known military sociologist who may have been on NPR not long ago talking about his experience at Princeton University. 50 years ago, in his class, something like 450 members in a class of 900 served.
This is Charlie Moskos from Northwestern. We know him well on this show.
Well, in the equivalent, if my memory serves me properly, last year, the year before, was something like 10. So that's the that is one of the great issues. And I think there's another issue that's worth exploring, and that is the whole question of what the military needs. The American Army now has about 490,000 soldiers on active duty. In World War II, obviously, these are not commensurables that we're talking about, but for comparison's sake, we were a country of 135 million. 8.5 million were on active duty in the Army alone. Is a country of 300 million with an active duty army of 485,000, putting the Marines, the Navy, and the Air Force aside for the moment, with an activist foreign policy and with a very large mission to accomplish in Iraq, we simply don't have enough soldiers to do what it is we are being asked to do.
We read Lieutenant General James Helmley, commander of the Army Reserve, saying that the reserve is rapidly degenerating into a broken force. And when the cash has to be broken out to induce Americans who need it to sign up and come in, he worried out loud in this memo to the Pentagon that the Army risks being seen as a mercenary army. Jack Beatty joined this conversation. This is a fascinating, complex kind of construction here. Josiah Bunting saying, get the whole country in here or you don't have a proper democracy working. You don't get that kind of melting pot and unity and understanding of what military commitments actually mean. On the other hand, one suspects that some number of those privileged Americans are voting with their feet as a kind of they're just not buying into the foreign policy, the war. Then, on the other hand, he points out they no longer feel obligated. It's like someone else's job. How do you see what's going on here, Jeff?
Well, you know, in the lead up to this war, Chuck Hagel, the senator from Nebraska.
Republican.
Yeah. Said that if Richard Perle, who was one of the leading hawks in the Pentagon Defense Advisory Board, if Richard Perle, that Richard Perle should lead the first wave into Baghdad. Well, if Richard Perle or Richard Perle's son or William Crystal's son or the Bush twins were in the Army, we would not be in Iraq.
So is that an argument that supports, are you supporting Josiah Bunting? Are you saying get everybody in there?
It is a break on an adventurous foreign policy. That is one of the things that brought the Vietnam War to its close. And it's you know, one of the distressing things now is there isn't an anti-war movement, partly because there isn't, the war isn't coming after my kid and your kid and the other person's kid. It's somebody else's fight. And our politicians are very brave with other people's kids. But, you know, there's another issue here, and that is that I think the moral prophet of our time is Dr. Johnson. Yeah, Samuel
All
Johnson.
All right, Boswell. What?
Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. And I think that you could hold that over our time today, and it just says so much. And I think
who are you putting that label on then, Jack? Patriotic soldiers who are out there, are they scoundrels?
I'm putting it on politicians who are brave with other people's kids. And Madison in the Federalist warns, he said, the great temptation of a president is to use military force for his own political ends. And we know from the Pentagon Papers that president after president basically said, look, if I get out of Vietnam, I'm going to lose. So I'm going to fight till the last kid from Kansas. And what I'm trying to say is we have to get away from this identification with the state. The state is a kind of great Moloch that consumes people. And one of the, you know, if you were to just look at it as an idol, it comes after people and kills them. War, Randolph Bourne said, is the health of the state. That's not saying anything good. And maybe the divorce that elites feel from the wars on is because after Vietnam, that attitude that there's something foul about this business of saluting the flag and patriotism and, you know, going out for battle, that maybe that attitude is kind of a prophylactic preventing them from identifying with such ventures as what we're involved in now.
Josiah Banting, how about, there's a lot there to chew on, but what about this notion that perhaps the elite's absence is a principled absence?
I don't believe it's a principled absence, except perhaps in some isolated cases. I don't know if you watched the Super Bowl the other night. Most
sure.
People did, but there was a great patriotic outpouring of parades and singing of anthems and so on before the game. And a number of contemporary soldiers were marched onto the field and proudly paraded and received the crowd's applause. I wonder how many people in that crowd who spent $2,000 or $3,000 for a seat to watch this game themselves have any direct interest in, that is to say through a son or daughter, in the war. I think what's happened is that this war, which we read about all the time and which we see briefly in the morning between little peons to Brad Pitt or things like that. Mm. I think this is a war which is almost like an Orwellian 1984 war. It's something that's back there. The war is going on today, and people read about it and shrug and move away from it.
But aren't you glossing over the active resistance, opposition to the war? Half the country nearly, in effect, voted against it in the November election. So
that's true, but I would not describe that is active resistance to the war.
Opposition,
opposition. But I think voting decisions were made on a number of things, of which the war was one. But I think what I'm saying is there's a relative lack of engaged interest in what's happening. One of the interesting features of this debate, Tom, is that people's opinions about the draft and about who should serve are all over the map, and they do not track with their normal political identifications. You've got people like Representative Charlie Rangel here in New York City, who's a passionate spokesman in behalf of an immediate draft, and you have large numbers of well-known conservatives who think a draft is a terrible idea. Again, I would like to make this point. Churchill talked about the soft underbelly of Europe, somebody said, and a private crawls forward 3 feet in the rain. I think that makes the point very, very eloquently. If you are a citizen of this country, and if you are given the plenitude of its opportunities, you should be eligible to serve in the military and pay and bear some of the burden to have these kinds of things.
And what if some large number of the population sees the country's policy, its foreign policy, as unworthy of that sacrifice?
I think I would make a distinction between unworthy and immoral.
Apply either label.
Frequently, the United States, its citizenry, sees wars that the country has gotten into as, for one reason or another, regrettable, deplorable, immoral. And yet, when there is military conscription and your number comes up, you're forced with a stark moral decision. You can be a conscientious objector, which is an honorable thing to do, or you can go out and serve.
And today there's an easy out. There's no draft. You just don't walk toward the enlistment office. Josiah Bunting, please stand by. Jack Beattie, I want to welcome to this conversation someone who's made his own decision on this front. We're joined now from Virginia Beach, Virginia, by Ensign Tim Barrett. He's an officer, a young officer in the U.S. Navy, graduated from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, fine institution, in 2003. He was part of the Navy ROTC. He had a choice of whether to go on with that, go forward into active service or not. He graduated from a fine school and did. Ensign Tim Barrett, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening. Thank you.
I wish you'd explain to us, you're part of the class that Josiah Bunting says, in general, is not stepping forward for military service. Why did you?
Well, I think I should preface it by saying that I did join the Navy before September 11th, in the pre-September 11th era, mm-hmm. before there was this sort of rush to patriotism, if you will.
All the more interesting, in a way.
Yes, indeed. And I saw it as sort of a unique opportunity. I'm not sure that everyone in the audience might know that, or your listeners might know that the Navy actually offers sort of a free test drive, if you will, of Navy ROTC, allowing students to spend their first year in the ROTC program with no obligation. So my dad sparked my interest in ROTC when I was in high school in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and a close family friend whom I admired a great deal was a Navy captain. He encouraged me to investigate the opportunities that the Navy had. But I had always sort of looked at the Navy with a profound respect, but kept it at a safe distance, if you will.
And did you look at it as a way to help pay for school in a substantial part, Tim, or
well,
not, Ensign Barrett?
There's no denying that that there are definite financial benefits to it. However, ultimately, that was not the main portion of my decision because, like I said, the Navy gives you one free year where they will pay your tuition mm-hmm. and you can participate as what they call a midshipman in the mm-hmm. ROTC program.
Mm-hmm. So you went on.
I did. I figured I'd give it the old college try for the 1 year, and afterwards it became something more. I realized that at Northwestern in particular, naval service and military service is rare. The Northwestern ROTC unit, although it's a great unit, we've been at about half of our capacity since roughly the Vietnam era.
And now that you're in, Ensign Barrett, when you look to your left and to your right, do you see the educated class of America there with you in the U.S. Navy?
I do. I think it's unfair to characterize naval officers or naval personnel in general as persons who are uneducated in any way, but I understand the general's point that in general that the elite class, you know, is far less represented in the military.
However, do you think that's a problem?
I do. I think, actually, backing to my Northwestern days, the provost at Northwestern, when we first arrived with the ROTC program, challenged us with a provocative statement that truly inspires me today, which was that not only could we serve our country, but that it was in our interest to join the military and stay in, students from Northwestern and other sort of top schools, in an effort to shape the military from within, you know, that you can't really criticize an organization that you know nothing about. And truly, the only way to affect change is to be within an organization. So for that reason, I think it's important that that the organization have members of all different classes because we all have something different to offer.
Well put and well remembered. Ensign Tim Barrett, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I want to turn to our callers. Chris is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a Navy veteran from the first Gulf War.
Okay.
Or Gulf War One, whatever you pick. And I agree very much with the general sentiments about the elite class not being represented in the military. I was going to ask a question, and it was something like, when it came to the voting in the election,
yeah.
Do you think a majority of the people that were for this war do not have a son or daughter that's serving right now?
So you wonder, you're saying take the spotlight and put it right on those who support the war, and are they stepping up with enlistment?
Exactly, because to me, that whenever I hear a right-wing radio talk show host talk, like, it sounds like forward he cried from the rear. And it really angers me as a citizen because I went and did my service in, and my brother was also in the Navy, too, as well, as he was in Bosnia, which was extremely unpopular at the time.
You're saying who's shouting forward and where are they standing?
Exactly.
Chris, thanks very much for your call. Josiah Bunting, General Bunting, your response?
I'm very sympathetic to that response, and I would make the point again that if you have had that military experience, if you have been particularly in the what are called the ground gaining arms, if you've been boots on the ground, you keep with you for the rest of your life a clear sense of what it is other people who are in the same position are doing. And if you happen to be in government or in politics in a command position of some sort, a president, an elected officer, it seems to me you will know, you will understand much better the value of what you are calling on these people to lay on the line.
General Josiah Bunting, please stand by. We're talking tonight about privileged America ducking out of the military service in time of war. What do you think? Is it fair? Is it wrong for Americans who need the job to be the ones serving and dying? Is privileged America losing touch with the reality of military service? Is the head of the U.S. Army Reserve right to worry about America turning to a homegrown mercenary army? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about privileged America absent from the U.S. military. My guest is Lieutenant General Josiah Bunting III. His article in the winter issue of the American Scholar is Class Warfare. Is it wrong that America's most privileged families have abandoned military service? You can join us tonight. Why aren't privileged Americans sharing the burden? Because they think the foreign policy, the war, is wrong? Or because they assume it's someone else's job to do the fighting? If we're going to fight wars, should we all do the fighting? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dan is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I have my thumb on Madison's quote from the early part of our history. Anybody want to indulge a couple of sentences?
Sure. Let's hear it, Dan.
Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. As the parent of armies, war encourages debt and taxes, the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people.
Dan, I think we've got it. Let me ask you then. Are you suggesting by that the affluent who are not in the military today are wise and the serving are suckers?
What am I suggesting? I am suggesting that everybody in our republic, to the extent that it would be a democracy, has to have, as Ross Perot would say, some skin in the game. And if we do not, all of us, have some skin in the game, whatever the game is, it will be shuffled off to the least among us to do the dirty work.
Dan, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, here it is. On the one hand, you're saying, watch out, the state will call you to service that you may not want to be engaged in. On the other hand, Dan says, what about the skin in the game if we're going to be out there in the world?
I couldn't agree with him more. I think it's viciously unfair. I think it's a moral travesty that the rest of us just live with this, that we accept it, that these young men and women are dying. We're just kind of, there's no anti-war movement. And you know, the general suggests, well, you know, people who've been in the service, they know what it's like, and it changes them. Well, look at how our senators voted. Look how John Kerry voted. He voted for this war. Do you think in his heart he really thought this was a good venture? I can't believe it. Chuck Hagel, very decorated Marine on the ground, he voted for this war, even though he had all kinds of reservations he expressed about it. Max Cleland, he voted for the war. Did they do that out of some principle, or was that rather political fear?
Missing
and that
three
gets
limbs
right at what I'm
war.
Talking about. Patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel.
And if it had been their kids, you're saying this wouldn't happen. General Bunting, many people may have seen Michael Moore's film. There's the scene where he goes to a kind of a rundown mobile home in the woods, or you know, out on the outskirts of town, where a young man's getting ready to enlist, and it's clear from his surroundings he doesn't have a lot of economic opportunities. I think you're suggesting, many people may be perceiving these days, that is the bulk of the American military. People are pushed there by economic circumstances.
I don't know if that's true or not. I have not studied those data. I sense that that's obviously a major factor in their decision to go into military service. I would like to make a couple of adjoining points, if
please.
I may.
Yes.
You know, Dr. Johnson also said every man thinks meanly of himself for not having been a soldier. I suppose we could debate that for a long time.
Yeah.
But it does raise this point. Putting aside for the moment the question of the draft, which seems politically to be a non-starter, at least for the next 2 or 3 years, I think the armed services can do a much better job of recruiting on the campuses of these places than they are doing now. If I were still in the military, that would be something that would interest me a great deal. Get your best, your most eloquent, your most evangelistic military kinds of people who themselves are beneficiaries of this sort of education, and let them set up a shop on the campuses of these places and appeal to the idealistic instincts of the young men and women who are there.
And are you saying to those young men and women, my country, right or wrong, what if they agree with the war?
Yeah. I think what I'm saying is the country as presently constituted in its foreign policy, is going to find itself in situations where people are going to have to go in harm's way. It is much better that that burden be shared. It is much more moral that that burden be shared. And above all, it is incumbent on you, as people who are being well-educated to become young leaders, it is incumbent on you to go out and serve and lead those young people who are being attracted into the military service.
Let's turn to another call. Charles is calling from Cherry Point, North Carolina. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
Yes, I'm currently a captain in the Marine Corps. I'm an aviator by trade, but right now I'm currently a forward air controller for an infantry battalion.
Mm-hmm.
I dare say that I enjoy flying a tad bit more than I like walking around the ground.
Where have you served, Captain?
I was in Iraq in 2003. I flew there and then just recently got back from Afghanistan in December of 2004. So I'm well-versed in both the air and the ground. And the point I'd like to make is that I have several squadron mates as well as some chums in my battalion who are graduates of Vanderbilt, Princeton, Notre Dame, the like. I myself am a Purdue graduate.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to bring up a couple of points. One is the fact that after World War II kicked off, Wild Bill Donovan built the OSS, the
Intelligence Service,
CIA, correct. Mm-hmm. Basically, he recruited the best and the brightest he could find from Wall Street, from Manhattan, all over the East Coast, and some of the most prominent schools. And their success, I guess, needs no explanation.
Mm-hmm. They won.
In World War II. Likewise, another gentleman once said that England's battles of World War I were won on the football fields of Eton. And therefore, I think that it's good that we have people who step up from those particular classes and those particular universities and, quote-unquote, step up to the plate and get down and dirty.
And, Charles, despite what you describe as your comrades there in the field from very fine universities, including your own Purdue, do you agree with General Bunting that class is more broadly missing?
I would have to say that I do agree with him. And I think that as far as trying to sell that, a recruiting job in that class, it's going to be a very tough sell. As the previous gentleman said, they're going to have to bring out the best and brightest recruiters and really put forth the idea. Obviously, these guys don't need money for college. So
right.
You're going to have to put forth the idea of, you know, patriotism. This is for you to, quote-unquote, pay it back before you, live the affluent life apparently later.
Captain, we've got it. Thanks for calling in. Josiah Bunting, we've just got a couple minutes left here. I want to hear you more. You quoted Charlie Moskos earlier. He also has described talking with recruiters in the military. And he said he asked them if they would prefer to have their advertising budget tripled or have Jenna Bush, the president's daughter, joined the Army. He said they unanimously chose the Jenna option, but you and I know she's not going to join. So what's going to bring about this change? Anything?
It seems to me you need a completely different orientation of people who are governors, senators, presidents, people who themselves are saying the kinds of things that most of your callers and I have been suggesting this evening, people who challenge this younger generation, absent a draft, to go into military service. I might add, finally, the historical precedents are not encouraging. I don't want to get apocalyptic on you, Tom, but study the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. When you decoupled military service from citizenship, when you decoupled even the liability to be called up from citizenship, that's when things began to fall apart. And I much fear that 30 or 50 or 100 years down the road, when those who are making decisions for war and peace have not themselves been the beneficiary of military service, you're going to have a much less reliable judgment about matters of war and peace than we should have.
You quote William Shakespeare on this front from Julius Caesar saying, "The abuse of greatness is when it disjoins remorse from power."
Yeah.
That is, those for whom the war is being waged are disjoined from its costs.
When Shakespeare says remorse, he means pity.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. They don't quite understand what it is that they are calling on people to do. That's dangerous, that's regrettable, and it's wrong.
Do you think it will, I guess you do, that it will affect American policy, this absence in the years ahead, that the policy itself may be different because of that absence?
You know, one of the early fears of an all-volunteer force, which I'm happy to say has not been realized, is that the volunteer force would be a sort of right-wing, here-to-eternity kind of army. That has not happened. But I think there is a fear much later on that the willingness to employ a force of volunteers is going to be much greater than would be the willingness to employ a balanced force from all citizens.
Well, it's a complex and fascinating picture that you paint. Lieutenant General Josiah Bunting III, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org, click on forums. In a moment, a look at the downfall of a controversial journalist. This is On Point. Jeff Gannon, the controversial reporter for the conservative website Talon News, who gained notoriety for asking softball questions during White House press conferences, resigned from his job today after becoming the target of liberal weblogs. Gannon had little journalistic experience, and the website he wrote for is operated by a Texas-based Republican Party delegate. His questions during press conferences were so friendly to the Bush administration that some have questioned whether he was a White House plant. Take, for instance, the question he asked when called on by President Bush during a press conference last month.
Senate Democratic leaders have painted a very bleak picture of the U.S. economy. Harry Reid was talking about soup lines, and Hillary Clinton was talking about the economy being on the verge of collapse. Yet, in the same breath, they say that Social Security is rock solid and there's no crisis there. How are you going to work? You said you're going to reach out to these people. How are you going to work with people who seem to have divorced themselves from reality?
It turns out Reid never asked about soup lines, never talked about it. That quote was fabricated during a satire segment on Rush Limbaugh's radio show. Last February, when the rest of the White House press corps was grilling Scott McClellan on President Bush's military service, Gannon jumped in and appeared to rescue the press secretary with a question that turned the heat on to John Kerry.
Since there have been so many questions about what the president was doing over 30 years ago, what is it that he did after his honorable discharge from the National Guard? Did he make speeches alongside Jane Fonda denouncing America's racist war in Vietnam? Did he testify before Congress that American troops committed war crimes in Vietnam? And did he throw somebody else's medals at the White House to protest a war America was still fighting?
One of the blogs that's been calling for Gannon's removal from press events is Media Matters for America. Its president and CEO, David Brock, joins us now. Brock's a former conservative who has since renounced elements of his past writings as untrue. David Brock, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being back on Point.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
So who is Jeff Gannon, David?
Well, as we've discovered, Jeff Gannon is someone who was working for what they call a conservative news site, TalonNews.com, has been in the White House press briefings for, my understanding is, almost 2 years, asking a series of very loaded questions of the type that you just described. And this website, Talon News, shares an editor with the owner of another conservative website that doesn't even pretend to be about journalism, called GOPUSA.com, which is run by Republican Party activists in Texas.
How did Jeff Gannon become part of the White House press corps? There must be there's a credentialing procedure there.
There is. Apparently what happened is Jeff Gannon, and that's as the Washington Post reported on Monday, that is a pseudonym. Jeff Gannon was rejected by the Congress, by the Senate Press Gallery, for clearance, and apparently that's required to get a hard pass, is what they call it, at the White House. And so he was unable to obtain that hard pass credential. What he's been doing for more than a year is obtaining a daily pass, and according to the Boston Globe, being waved in to receive that pass. So he's obviously being waved in by people at the White House. We still don't know whether he was being waved in and whether there was Secret Service clearance for the pseudonym or for his actual name. And I think that part of the story is still developing.
Is there any evidence that Jeff Gannon, or at least the man who goes by that pseudonym, was deliberately planted by the White House to ask softball questions? Or is this just, you know, a reporter with a political angle who's showing up?
Well, there's no evidence. We don't know the answer to that. On our website at MediaMatters.org, we did do a lot of research to attempt to document how Jeff Gannon's presence could have been of significant utility to the White House in bailing out Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, when he is under tough questions that he doesn't want to answer, in putting out certain conservative spin and propaganda into the press briefing. And I think it would be hard to imagine that White House officials didn't notice what we noticed at Media Matters, which is the Harry Reid incident that you quoted from wasn't a one-time event, that there was a pattern here. But we still don't know who knew what in terms of his being there.
But the suggestion or the fear, concern, I guess as I read it, is that this is part of a bigger picture. I mean, we had the incidents of Armstrong Williams and others who got money from the government and appeared to produce quote-unquote journalism in return for that. There was the incident of video being fed to news services as news stories. I guess the allegation that there's a kind of propaganda machine at work here, including, I don't know if this is an explicit allegation or just a concern, you tell us, that it infected the White House press corps itself through Jeff Gannon.
Well, this is clearly it's clearly a reality. Now, Congresswoman Louise Slaughter has written a letter today to President Bush asking for, you know, further clarification as to whether this is tied into the Armstrong-Williams payola scandal, in the sense that it could have been part of an effort to mislead. Now, the reality is the White House press briefing is, as of a couple weeks ago, when President Bush held a press conference, that was nationally televised. As you said, what we picked up at Media Matters was not only that the question appeared to be biased, but that it was based on false information, that it was a fabricated quote by Harry Reid. And so we think that this is, and I wrote to Scott McClellan a week ago asking whether it's appropriate to have people who have zero journalism credentials, who are tied to explicitly partisan organizations, and who are asking questions based on things we know are false.
And his reply?
Be in there. Scott McClellan had no reply to us. I believe he's been quoted in the press as saying that he doesn't believe it's his role as White House press secretary to be deciding who is and who is not a journalist. But as I mentioned earlier, there is a credentialing process up on Capitol Hill.
And maybe it got short-circuited. We're out of time with that. But David Brock, we're grateful to you for being with us tonight. David Brock with Media Matters for America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.